You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with Tony Hawk. If pro skateboarders have resumes, Tony Hawk's is undoubtedly among the longest and most envied. Though he's the most decorated skater ever, with the highest contest win percentage of any sport, and a $1 billion video game series, Hawk has arguably given more to the sport than he's received. Watching Hawk skate is a testament to artistry as much as athleticism. His autobiography required an entire glossary to catalog the tricks that are his legacy to the skateboarding lexicon. His Tony Hawk Foundation has contributed over $4 million to develop 500 skate parks around the world. He's also been skateboarding's foremost advocate, promoting it through some of its darkest days. Though smashing his pelvis while attempting a full loop dressed in a gorilla suit probably doesn't count. Hawk joins Off Camera to talk about the evolution of the sport from its scrappy underground beginnings to X Games behemoth. He shares his thoughts on the vital role of artistry and individuality in athletics and shares his continued love and commitment to the sport. Now a father of four that can still stick the most difficult tricks ever invented, we learn why at age 44, he still makes his primary living on four wheels. As it turns out, Tony Hawk simply can't not skate. So pull up a chair and listen in.
So Tony Hawk.
Sam Jones.
How you doing?
Good, thank you.
Hey, I really appreciate you doing this. I've followed your career since the beginning, really. And as a matter of fact, when I was in my first year of college, the Bones Brigade video show came out. And I was stuck in Spokane, Washington. And 5 feet of snow, and we must have watched that video like 100 times. And still, like yesterday, I pulled it up on the computer, and that music that comes up right before your section in the Del Mar Hall is still like it was yesterday, you know?
Oh, that's funny. Wow, thank you.
And I skated, and I was in some contests in that pool, so I kind of followed you growing up, so it's an honor to have you here.
Oh, thanks. It's not too many people can say they skated Del Mar.
Yeah, right. I slammed so hard in the Del Mar pool once on just a rock and roll, and I just caught my trucks going.
That's how I knocked out my teeth.
On a rock and roll.
The first time, yeah.
No kidding. Now you recently participated in the Stacy Peralta documentary,
yep.
Mm-hmm. The Bones Brigade autobiography,
yep.
And I wondered if kind of reliving all that brought up some emotional memories for you.
It did. I mean, I guess it's funny you say that because. You know, a lot of the guys in that are featured in that got very emotional being interviewed and things, and I think me especially, and like Tommy Guerrero, we don't really have those moments in the documentary, so it's kind of like we look like we're more cavalier about it. That's how I felt when the whole thing came out. I was like, if you look at it, you think, oh, these guys just think, well, what's next? Do you know what I mean? Like, well, we did that, now what?
Right.
And all the other guys are like, oh, just broken down that it ended and it's over, which I did feel like that a bit. But at the same time, I didn't feel like the end of the Bones Brigade was the end of my skate career. I felt like I wanted to still be in skating, if not doing it myself. But I think the time when I got emotional and it didn't really fit into the story was when Stacy was asking me sort of what motivates me to keep skating and to keep promoting skating, and that's when I got more emotional, because I said it's from what you taught me, it's to share what this is, and it's so amazing and magical and it's so creative and it's so healthy for kids, and I feel like no one really saw that when we were younger, and I want to promote that, and you're the one who instilled it in me that there's something very valuable here.
Do you kind of look back at that time as a particular golden age or with more of a special, you know, feeling towards it?
I definitely have, I do love that time. I mean, it has special meaning to me for sure, but at the same time, and it was a very small community, and it just felt so experimental. I think that's what I liked about it, is anything goes. You could do, you know, you could try any new thing, any new technique, and it was like, wow, no one's done that. You know, that's something new, and maybe some other people want to do it. Now, not that everything's been done, but there is a certain I guess there's a certain path people fall into now, and you know, you've got to learn these tricks, and this is what's hot, and this is what's considered hard, and this is what's considered cool. And if you got all those in your bag, then you can go on to this level of skating. And do you know what I mean? It's just more structured now than it used to be. But at the same time, I'm amazed at how big it's gotten. So I can't say that like those were the days.
Sure.
Because they were the days in some respects, but now it's incredible. You know, it's incredible. Like, I'm 44. I still make a living riding my skateboard. That could not have happened in back in the day.
Right.
Because either you were considered old or outdated, or you just couldn't, there wasn't enough people making a living that you could do it into your adult life.
Sure. Well, and also there wasn't this video archive that existed. Like, when you rolled into a contest and some guy from out of town, say the first time you saw Jeff Phillips or Jeff Gibson or Monty Nolder, like, you were literally, that's the only time you got to see them skate.
Yeah.
And I think there's something interesting about that. Like, you go to someone's ramp in the middle of Virginia and you walk away going, oh, wow, I never thought to try that or whatever.
Right, right. Yeah, oh, I think a lot of it was like that then. You know, the magazines were 6 months at best behind of what was really happening. And so if you got a chance to see it live, you really saw what was happening in modern skateboarding and the contemporaries and the... I mean, it was such an evolution of innovation, the things that were being created, and even down to street skating. I mean, street skating was just being tested then, and then suddenly people realized that you can use the urban landscape as your skate park, and that's when everything changed. That's when that leveled the playing field. Anyone can go out and try to skate because now your handrail is the skate park.
I think that is... In terms of the innovation and the growth of skateboarding, it was very reactionary to, you know, there was that certain time when parks got taken away. If that hadn't happened, maybe street skating wouldn't have...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It wouldn't have been so prolific, that's for sure.
Right. Now, Stacy he wasn't tremendously older than you, but when you were in kind of the height of that time, you're 17, 18, whatever, how did you look at Stacy? Who was he to you at that point?
He was a driving force in skateboarding for sure. I mean, I knew of him as a pro. And then when he started putting together the PAL team, then I just thought, oh, well, he's this guy that is an eye for talent. Because everyone on the team were considered some of the best skaters and the most innovative. Guys like Alan Gelfin, Ray Bones Rodriguez, who Bones Brigade is named after, Steve Caballero, Mike McGill, Teddy Bennett, there were all these guys that you know, I was looking at as sort of an up-and-coming amateur, not even up-and-coming, I was more unknown amateur, going, wow, those guys are, you know, they're on a whole different level. And so for me to see Stacy, it was like he was, I guess, for me, he was a figurehead. He was this guy that you would not aspire to, but you would just have this... awe of respect for. And so when he, like, one time I was at Whittier and the Bones Brigade showed up and you just knew it immediately, like there was a hush in the skate park and Stacy was walking in with these guys and they all had these like cool colored helmets and, you know, the Bones Brigade shirts, and they came in and like Steve Caballero was smaller than me and I was little and he's blasting airs like 4 feet high and I was just like, this is the future. Like, someone just walked in with a time machine. And I was super excited, and then to have caught his attention somehow through those couple years after that was amazing to me, that he even noticed who I was.
What did he evolve into for you once you'd had a relationship for a few years with him? Was he a father figure, or was he a coach?
He was more of a coach, for sure. I mean, definitely, definitely a parental guide, so to speak, you know, when we were traveling and things like that. But no, I mean, as much as he was a babysitter too, because it was just kind of, he had to figure out, you know, where we're all going to sleep. And when we were in LA for events, only Lance was from LA. Everyone else was flying in or driving here. And so we all stayed at Stacy's parents' house.
No kidding.
Yeah, I mean, that's where we there was like one room and then there was the couch and you just had to find a place to sleep.
And was there ever any conversations that you think Stacy had with your parents about, like, you know, I, I've I'm going to take care of your kid. He's in good hands. Like, was there those things
that went
on?
Yeah, I think for sure. I think my, yeah, but it was just a different time then too. It was a different time in terms of what you let your kids do. I mean, they're, you know, not that the parents were lax back then, but it was just less concern for sketchy people.
Right.
That's true. You know, and it's probably not a good thing, but it was just more like, yeah, go ahead. I mean, people were hitchhiking back then, you know? So it was just like, yeah, go ahead. Okay. You're going to LA for the, you know, for 5 days. Go ahead.
Oh, that's amazing.
Hope you're in good hands. And my dad was a little more concerned because he had already had three kids. And so, you know, he definitely vetted Stacy in some way. But he trusted him a lot for sure. And he was already trustworthy. He was already established in the skate industry. It wasn't like he was some sketchy dude that was trying to start a skateboard company and,
right,
you know, gather the right team. And then who knows what's going to happen.
And your dad knew the world pretty well, because as you became more obsessed and skated every day, he actually started the NSA. Did he start Castle as well, or?
He did. He started. He saw a lack of organization in competitions then. I mean, there were some competitions, but they were very scarce, and there was no governing body anymore. There used to be, kinda, but you know, there were a few series. And so he took it upon himself to start an amateur circuit, and eventually, well, a California amateur circuit, and then eventually a pro circuit in the NSA, and he got the support of the big companies then. There were only really five main skateboard manufacturers that mattered for the most part, and so he got their support. You know, he got a group of judges, and still to this day, even though it's changed names, it's called World Cup Skate now. It's the same. It's relatively the same organization. A lot of the same people behind it, and they're the ones that sanction X Games, do tour, you know, all the big events.
Looking back now, do you realize what an incredible commitment that was for a dad? Because basically, like, he turned his life into your life. He didn't say, "Okay, I have to do my thing," and if there's time left over for you, he completely committed to your life.
Yeah, well, in hindsight, it's amazing, and it's very devoted. At the time, it feels intrusive. Because at the time, you know, I'm sort of just coming into my own. I've gone through puberty, and I have this sort of freedom. I can go travel and go to these big events, and my parents are there.
Right.
And so that's a little awkward, you know what I mean? And then my parents are there. They're not just there. They're kind of running the event. And so that, you know, that stifles your freedom a little bit. And also there's obviously, you know, there's whispers of favoritism and things like that. So those kind of things are really hard to deal with. And my dad and I actually came to a head at some point, and I was just like, you gotta back off. You gotta get out of here.
And was it a big kind of
kinda, yeah. I mean, it was pretty heavy, yeah. And you know, and he's like, well, how are you gonna get to the events? I go, I don't know, I'll find a ride. I can't have you there all the time. There's too much pressure on me. There's too many, you know, there's a stigma attached to you being there and to me doing well. And so it was tricky, but he took it to heart. He didn't back off completely. I mean, because he couldn't just walk away from these organizations he helped to form. But he definitely understood that I was, you know, I needed some sense of freedom too.
You know, I did feel at the time like there was some backlash too in the industry of that. Like, I remember reading Thrasher magazine, and if there was a picture of your dad, it kind of looked like an authority picture.
Yeah.
And I don't think you had a cover of Thrasher till late 86, which seemed insane to me. And I wonder if that was hard on you in terms of your peers and like feeling that.
It was, but at the same time, it just gave me more motivation to prove myself. Because at some point it was like, okay, well, if they think that I'm doing well because my dad's involved, then I'm going to step it up this much more. And so it probably helped me in terms of my inspiration and my motivation to get better and to do better and to, you know, just to prove them wrong.
Was there a time when, you know, you'd be at a contest and really feel like a lot of these people are like kind of talking behind my back or saying certain things? Like, did you feel a bit like, ostracized because of that, or?
Yeah, for sure. And that, like I said, that just gave me more incentive to do better.
You know, right.
It wasn't like I was sitting there pining for their acceptance, although I would have liked it. It wasn't, you know, I just thought, okay, well, I'm not going to gain their acceptance through friendship. I'm going to have to gain it through respect for my skills.
And did you have that thought at that age? Like,
yeah,
that's a pretty mature thought.
Sure. Because there were definitely times when, you know, people would say stuff to my face too, just like, oh, well, someone got more practice, you know, or things like that. And I was just like, well, I'm just following the schedule that you're following. You know what I mean? I am playing by the rules.
Right.
So there were times like that where I just had to buck up and you know, let my skating do the talking.
Yeah. Was there any particular skaters that were harder on you than others, or?
Yeah, definitely. Well, definitely the NorCal crew. I mean, there was sort of this NorCal-SoCal rivalry thing going on, Independent, Tracker, and those guys. I mean, those guys would literally boo me at contests.
God, that's... you know, it's funny, because I think that's... No matter how hard you try to get away from that, because skating was the thing for kids to do who didn't want to feel that way in football or basketball.
Well, that's the funny thing is back then, skating was so small in terms of an industry and a lifestyle and a community. And then there's you're really going to choose sides within that little bubble of people? Like, there were polarizing differences, and that was weird to me because I felt like we were all considered outcasts. We were all uncool in the mainstream eye, and yet we're going to have infighting?
Right. Well, and I'm sure a huge part of it was the fact that you were already at you were younger than a lot of them, a lot of that crowd, and you were progressing so quickly. I'm sure a lot of it was just plain fear and jealousy, right?
Maybe so, yeah.
Now, what do you think it is about you that will make you keep falling till you learn a trick and keep committing to something?
It's because I know it's possible, and I'm willing to struggle through the learning process and even change my approach to doing something just to figure out how to do it. And so I guess I never wanted to back down from a challenge, even one that I just posed for myself.
So would you kind of have to psych yourself up? Because you knew you were going to slam on some tricks, like... There was no way around learning certain things.
Yeah,
right?
But I think that's the kiss of death, is if you're convinced that you're going to fail or fall or get hurt, that will come to fruition because that's what you're visualizing. I was willing to get hurt along the way, but I didn't visualize myself getting hurt along the way. And I think that's what stops a lot of people, and that's really what separates a lot of people from being world champions or from being as good as they can, because they stop at some point saying, oh no, I am not capable of this, or I'll probably get hurt doing this. And if you approach anything with that hesitation, you're going to fail. I always approached it like, this is going to work. I'm going to figure this out, even if it takes me hundreds of attempts. And I wasn't, you know, the idea of falling and getting back up again, that didn't really bother me at all. It was, you know, and it's strange now, because when we were doing it in those days, you know, we were striving to learn tricks. But when you're striving to learn a trick in those days, and like in the 80s, you're striving to learn a trick that you're going to keep in your arsenal, that you're going to be able to do a lot. Nowadays, I'm striving to learn tricks that I know I'm only going to do one time.
And film them and move
on. And film them and document it, and it's over. And I mean, like, I did that exact thing yesterday. I learned a trick. It took me so long to do it, and I don't ever want to do it again.
But you made it.
I made it.
Check
I got it
off.
On film. We got it. Yeah. Actually, you missed the shot the first time, and I was trying to hide how disappointed I was, because like it didn't really pan down enough, and I was just like, oh, I can't live with that. I got to do it again. And it took a while to do it again, but that's the mindset now, and that's how far and how technical skating has become. That these things are, you know, really, really difficult. You're only going to make one out of 100, maybe. But we live in a day and age where you can get it on video. It's up on YouTube, and it's out there, and people respect that.
That brings up a good point, because back then you would learn a trick and then you would have to work it into a routine.
Yeah.
And then you'd have to save it for the contest. Yeah. And then you'd have to learn it on a new piece of terrain.
Yeah.
So going back a little bit to falling, was there ever a fall that you took that deterred you from doing a trick and you just said, well, there's too high a price to pay on that?
There were a couple times in my pursuit of doing a 900 that I really was done with it. The first time I tried to really make one, I was leaning forward too far and I broke my rib when I just fell into the flat bottom and I broke a rib up here and it actually felt like I broke my collarbone. And so that gave me pause, and that was at a time when I wasn't really making a good living skating. And I mean, I'll never forget that day, because I did that, like I was trying it. My son Riley, who's my oldest son, but then he was in kindergarten. I was late to pick him up to kindergarten because I was stuck trying this trick at the ramp. I broke my rib trying it, but I still had to get there to pick him up. You know what I mean? There was like this moment in life where it was like, what am I doing? You know, I'm trying this trick that's impossibly hard for what? For what appreciation or for what? There's no, do you know what I mean? It wasn't like there was going to be a light at the end of the tunnel where, oh, you make this and then you're going to somehow profit from it, or that. And not that that was ever my motivation, but at the same time, I had a child and I couldn't be killing myself on trying a super hard trick during the day because I had to provide for him. So that was a hard moment for me. And that's kind of when I stopped trying it for a while.
Oh, that's amazing, because it ends up being the trick that kind of propels you even further into worldwide.
Yeah, and that wasn't in my mind at all back then.
Of course,
it was just
course.
Like, I want to do this trick. I mean, it was literally when I did it. It was on this ramp that was in a warehouse. It was the Plan B ramp at the time. I started trying it. My friend was shooting video, and I said, I'm going to try to make this one. And then, you know, he's got like a Hi8 camera, and I tried to make it, fell, and then I was like, I can't try it anymore. I'm already late to pick up Riley. And that was it. That was the day. You know what I mean? It wasn't like there was this big venue and a best trick event and there was announcers or anything. And then, but I guess, you know, I guess if there was some sort of synchronicity or destiny, that would have been it, you know, to not do it then and to do it when I finally did, which was the X Games.
I just think it's fascinating that those moments are often the moments that define us, because, yeah, you could easily take the position of, what am I doing? I got a kid, I'm learning this thing, what's the point? And yet to stick with it turns out to be probably the best decision career-wise.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that was, when you're asking me, was there a time or a fall or something that made you look back? That was probably the moment where I was like, why would I try this impossibly hard, you know, sort of holy grail of skateboarding right now in my life when I have so many other priorities that should take precedent over that?
Right.
And it wasn't until I got away from that, and then, you know, skateboarding started picking up again, and I found myself still a very successful competitor and to a new audience with the X Games and things like that, where I thought, oh, maybe I can come back to that. Come back to trying that because I've got nothing else. I don't know. It wasn't like I had nothing else to lose, but I just knew that this might be the time to try to figure that out again.
Right. Was there ever a moment when you kind of looked around and saw, you know, I'm different, or there's less commitment from some of these other skaters? And like, at some point, did you kind of see the formula a little bit for becoming better?
Did I see the formula in others, you mean?
Well, like seeing others maybe not committing as much or not trying as hard, or I mean, I wonder if, I guess I'm asking if you saw a difference between your will or your makeup, you know, psychologically than some of these other skaters.
Well, I guess I noticed that it took forming my own team to figure that out and to see that in others. I didn't really notice it in my peers, because my peers were my contemporaries at the time in the 80s. They were all really good as far as I could tell, you know what I mean? I didn't think, oh, this guy's not utilizing his talents enough, or this guy's not motivated enough. We were all sort of coming up together. It wasn't until I started my own team when I realized that there are people with incredible talent and no motivation. And then there are other people that are willing to work their ass off who don't have a natural ability, but will become successful because they're so determined. And I saw it, I mean, I saw it especially in a couple of guys that I first put on the Birdhouse team, namely Andrew Reynolds and Matt Beach. Matt Beach was, in my eyes, the most naturally talented skateboarder that I've ever seen. Everything came easy to him. And I, you know, when I would request these guys to go on tour, all I ask of them is that they skate for exhibitions and whatnot. Matt wouldn't skate half the time. I flew him to Europe. I didn't have any money then, you know, in our company, but I was flying these guys to Europe for competitions. He would go to the contest and not feel like skating. And I was like, how can you do that? You know, I was just thinking, not just to me, but to yourself. Like, you have this incredible talent and you just don't care. And then I saw Andrew Reynolds, who was the scrappy little guy, taking, not very clean, but in terms of his style, but trying some of the hardest stuff, taking the heaviest hits, but always skating his ass off and always trying. And he has become probably the most well-respected street skater today. Andrew Reynolds, I mean, he formed Baker Brand, Deathwish Skateboards. The community of the most hardcore skaters these days call him the boss, because he developed his style, because he worked his ass off. And he's the shining example of hard work.
Do you put yourself in one category more than the other, or do you see yourself as someone who kind of has both?
I think in my early days, I was just determined. I had a terrible style. I didn't do the gnarly tricks. I had to figure out my own way of doing airs because I was so scrawny. I didn't have the bulk to propel myself, so I figured out how to ollie into my airs, which was considered more of a circus way of doing it, which nowadays is the only way you're going to get any height. I mean, it's really the only way to do airs. Is you have to ollie into your airs, otherwise you're just reaching down and losing all your speed. But at the time that I started doing it, it was just considered weird. So I think, yeah, in terms of hard work. And then eventually I had so many tricks that I could do, but that was the only complaint people had about me, or the big critique of my style was that I had no style.
Right.
I was just a robot doing these tricks. And so I really worked on my style. You know, I worked on doing the same tricks, but with better flair and not so mechanical.
Right, right. Well, I do remember that when that Thrasher cover finally came out, you had no helmet on, you're doing like a stand-up frontside grind in a pool.
Oh.
And it was kind of like, oh, that looks totally different than what I think of him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It wasn't like I was trying to change my image.
No,
it was just more like, I've come so far in this aspect of my skating, I got to work on this and be more well-rounded because I want to be able to skate everything.
Right. Now, when I saw that Independent Trucks video you just did recently.
Yeah.
And it's like, you haven't lost a step. You're 44 years old and I'm 46, and I'm amazed that you're able to still do that stuff. I mean, there's that thing where you go up on the 8-step ladder and...
Oh, yeah.
It's the things you're doing are so technical and so insane at this age. And, I do wonder how you get motivated to go do those things. Even like you were saying yesterday, learning a new trick. What is the drive for you now? What is the reason you still do it?
It's the same as it ever was, really. It's, you know, my drive was never to be rich or famous. It was just to keep getting better and to push my limits. And so now my focus is a little different. You know, I'm not trying to break any height or spinning records, and I don't want to wake up with a broken rib again. And so I've turned my focus more to the technical aspects and you know, maneuvering the board and doing new types of grinds and things like that, which has been a blast for me. But it's the same. It's that it's that buzz. It's the moment that I make something I've never made before. I don't care if someone else has done it, but when I do something I've never done before, I get this rush, and it's the high that I'm always going for. And so I've learned a new way to get that high, and it's been amazing, you know, to be able to do it at, like I said, into my age, and to still be considered a contemporary has been amazing to me. But I guess I can't not do it at this point.
You still love it.
I still love it, yeah. And I'm still good at it. You know what I mean? I can still justify being a pro. I can still go out there and do exhibitions and do stuff that other people can't do. And so it's just more fun for me. It's I love it now, especially now, because I'm not necessarily doing it because I have to make a living at it. Not that I ever did it for those reasons, but there were times when I would sort of have to swallow my pride to go, you know, to go do this goofy commercial and, you know, wear some silly costume and right. do a couple of tricks because I needed the money. I needed to raise a family, and my skating was still at the forefront of what I wanted to do. Or, you know, doing demos in amusement park parking lots, three a day for $100 a day. That kind of stuff was what we had to do if we wanted to make a living skating. And now I don't have to do that, but I'm not going to quit.
Right. And is there also something of like you want to keep doing it? Because, I mean, I don't know if you feel this way, but I feel like if I don't do something for a while, I'll lose it a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Especially now, you know, just in terms of being older and you have a sense of atrophy, too, where if I don't skate for a week and I come back to the ramp, it seems so daunting.
Like, just a week?
Yeah, just a week, because it's like you get in this mode where you're active, and as you get older, you got to keep that pace up a little more regularly than you did when you were younger, because you were more flexible and you were more resilient and whatever. And now it's just harder to have any sort of sporadic physical exercise thing, you know, program. You've got to keep it regular. And so when I go skate, I try to skate at least 3 or 4 times a week. That sort of keeps me in tune, and you know, every once in a while I'll try something that I don't necessarily love doing, but I know it's going to keep my sort of demo arsenal up.
Right. Like if you stop doing a trick for 6 months or something, that trick may just disappear into the sunset.
Yeah,
right?
It just gets way harder to convince yourself you can do it too. I mean, with me these days, it's like I can still do 720s. I can still do 900 sometimes. But if I don't try it for a month, then it's like, can I really still do that?
And speaking of the 900, I know that now Tom Schaar pulled a 1080.
Yeah.
And he's 12. And the quote was, yeah, it was the hardest trick I'd ever learned, but it just wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, does it blow you away how fast this thing that, you know, this thing is progressing?
Yes and no. I think I am not surprised in the sense that these facilities are available to these kids to learn this stuff, you know, to try it into a foam pit, to try it on a bigger ramp with more airtime. That, I'm not jealous over that. It's just like we didn't have those options at all. If you're gonna try some, you gotta try it on the real deal, you know, either on cement or on a backyard ramp, and go. And now there's this way to sort of work up to these pretty magnificent moves, to test them out safely. And so when I see a guy like Tom, who, you know, he learned 720 when he was like 10 or 11 years old. I do remember that, because I got this video. Look at this kid does 720s, because he had his own ramp at his house. Firstly, and then he started going to these skate camps, you know, learning stuff in the foam pits. He's got the mega ramp. We didn't have anything close to that. Not that we would have known what to do with it, but, you know, these mega ramps that give you instantly 10 feet of airtime and a pretty big landing zone. And so it's only natural that stuff like that's going to start happening. And so I think it's amazing. I think it's great. I think it's awesome that these kids have those facilities and those opportunities available to them, and the support system in place. We just didn't have any of that stuff. You know, like very few of my friends' parents wanted them skating at all.
Right, right.
And you know, a guy like Tom, his parents are flying with him across to international destinations to do this because they're so proud of him and they want him to succeed at it.
That's amazing. The mega ramp is, to me, it's like this crazy phenomenon, because from an outsider sense, it looks so frightening and dangerous. But from a skater sense, you're like, well, there is a lot more transition to catch you. And,
yeah.
And things seem slowed down in some ways. Did you spend a lot of time with it?
Yeah, I've done it. I've done it quite a few times. The funny thing about the mega ramp is that it does look monstrous. And when you, even as a skater, experienced skater, you go there and you're like, you got to be kidding me. This ramp's 30 feet high. I mean, they are. They're 30 feet tall. And as you ride it, as you're trying to ride it, say you're starting from just the landing of the jump, you barely reach the top. It seems monstrous and it seems sort of out of reach. But if you hit it with the amount of speed you need, it feels normal because it's all relative.
Right.
So you're going three times as fast, but at the same time, your timing and your body motions are the same because you feel the ramp the way you feel a regular ramp. So the difference is that all of a sudden you're 15 feet above it instead of being your usual five. And that starts to mess with you. But riding it and the timing of it is not that difficult. It's just overcoming the confidence that, can I do this?
Right.
This is huge.
It's incredible. And was there, I guess there's a moment on that where you have to go to the top and drop in on that thing too.
Yeah, I've seen many people stand up there and not go.
Yeah.
Many.
And there's no kind of starting halfway up on that thing, is there?
No. No. Well, they have what they call the mini mega, which is an oxymoron, but it's basically like about half the size. And so if you're going to work your way up, maybe you can try that first. And they actually have sort of a roll over that bridges the jump if you wanted to go that way and just to feel the speed going
right
in and whatnot. But the funny thing about that whole mega ramp, the first time doing it, if you make it down the ramp, as long as you make it to the jump, you're going to clear it. Doesn't matter what position you're in, or if you even have your board with you, your body will follow that arch and just land down the ramp. So the most dangerous thing is if someone somehow falls just before they get to the jump and then go in the gap.
Right, or goes up the side of the, like,
yeah, but you got to be in pretty bad shape. You can't aim for the jump.
You shouldn't be on it in the first place. No, I mean, it's one of those things. When it first came around, I was just blown away. And it seemed like, and then I forget the guy's name that had that horrible slam where he pulled.
Oh, Jake Brown, yeah.
Jake Brown, mm-hmm. Where he pulled away. I mean, is that a common thing on that, to pull too far away?
That is somewhat common, but not as far as he went. But I think that when he fell, you know, these guys were kind of going, they were going as if they were invincible on this ramp. They were trying, and you know, get more speed, bigger gaps, 20-foot airs, and they were trying anything and everything. And at some point, you know, being a skater, I wasn't trying to break those records or anything, but being a skater and seeing it, I was like, you guys, this is dangerous. I mean, this stuff is, it's no joke. You're 20 feet up. If you bounce on the coping for 20 feet up, you're screwed. And then when Jake got hurt and that happened, I think that gave them all pause. And to be honest, you don't see them really trying to break those height records anymore.
Right.
You know, I think that gave everyone a sense of mortality.
Right.
And so they thought, okay, we can start getting technical with this air time that we have, but we don't need to try to break these height and distance limits anymore.
Do you think as these sports get more insane that there is that learning curve where some people kind of have to get hurt? I mean, just in the recent snow, the X Games, the Winter X Games with Caleb Moore on his snowmobile. I mean, do you look at that and go, that's a different thing, maybe that should be looked at? Is there some limits that should be put on that, or do you feel like that's just all part of it?
I don't think, like, in terms of, you know, I don't really know those guys or anything, but in terms of their attitude and their motivation, I don't think that anything would have stopped that. I mean, these guys doing backflips on snowmobiles, it wasn't ESPN that made them do that.
Right.
It wasn't an event that motivated them to make it happen. They just wanted to see if that was possible, you know, and it's very likely that they would have done it without any TV fanfare.
Right.
Of doing that stuff. So it's really hard when you put those sort of, not the blame, but the onus on on a network or on the event where I really believe that those guys love what they do and they would keep doing it. And you know, to put restrictions on that is tricky. I don't really know. I don't know the answer, to be honest. I know in terms of my own sport, these guys are trying to, they want to push the limits of what is humanly possible. And they love doing it. They love it. And if they get hurt along the way, they know the risks. They really do.
Right.
You know, and in the case of, back to skateboarding, in the case of Jake Brown, you know, he knew that risk for sure, and he came back to it. That's how much he loves it. You know, he took a horrific slam like that where people really thought he was dead. Like that, they thought that was the first fatality of the X Games. He's on the ground.
Right.
You know, lying there lifeless, and everyone's like, that's it, it's over. And he survived it, and he loves it so much, he's back on it.
It is. It's amazing.
I think the microscope is very much focused on our sports, action sports, extreme sports, or whatever, because people think that there is a careless attitude towards it. And I don't believe that at all. I mean, I know that these guys, they train for this stuff. You know, every risk is calculated. They work as hard as any athlete to do this kind of stuff. It's not like we're just trying something and hoping for the best.
Right. Although, I will say it was pretty wild on Winter X. The other guy that fell in his snowmobile went into the crowd. Apparently, he was like, he had 5 hours on a snowmobile. He was a motocross
freestyle guy. Ever. Yeah.
Honest. And that was
That's
like,
pretty careless. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, in terms of those kind of stipulations, that is strange that you would accept someone as inexperienced into an event like that. So I don't know the motivation right. behind that. And to be honest, I didn't see it, so I don't really have much to say. But I think that in terms of the professionals and the ones that are experienced, the ones that have come this far, they know what the risks are, and they accept them, and they are as dedicated as any mainstream athlete, as any ball player ever. And so to have the microscope so focused on what we're doing, I think is unfair.
I completely agree. I mean, it just takes so long for something to become accepted.
And yeah.
You've dealt with that your whole career, with having to be seen as an outsider by the mainstream and having the mainstream get what you do wrong over and over and over again. I'm sure that's like, it's tiring, and I'm sure it's nice to see, you know, acceptance coming as slow as it is.
No, I love it. And I never coveted skateboarding as this underground activity that I didn't want to share with people. You know, a lot of people, they feel very strongly that skating is this pure thing, and it shouldn't be shared with the general public. The general public doesn't deserve it. The mainstream media, the mainstream sporting, you know, they should have no hand in this. I never felt like that. I always wondered why no one appreciated skating more. You know, it's athletic, it's creative, it's artistic, and it really keeps you healthy. It keeps your sense of self-confidence up, and that's what it gave to me as a kid. And I always wonder, like, why didn't the other kids my age like it? I didn't understand. And so as I see the appreciation grow and I see how big it's gotten, I love it. I think it's amazing. You know, I think it's amazing that a kid that chooses to skate now literally has career opportunities in that. Even if it's not just being a pro, if it's being a film guy, a team manager, you know, like, he loves this sport and he can remain within it as a career. I think that's incredible that we've come that far.
Yeah, I agree completely. Before we move off of that whole slamming topic, I saw a video of you in a gorilla suit take this horrific slam on the loop. I wonder if that was your worst slam.
That
ever.
Was the worst, yeah. It broke my pelvis, yeah. That was, I mean, when you ask, you know, if there was a slam, that slam changed my life in terms of being cocky, being careless, and proving how much I love skating. Because, you know, to break your pelvis, I couldn't walk for like 2 months.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, I was pretty much bedridden, and I started skating about 3 months later. It took me about a year to even get my confidence back up to do tricks that I used to take for granted that I would do in my sleep. But it showed me how much I love skating, that I was willing to persevere and go through those motions to get back to where I was.
Yeah, it really made me realize also, though, what a ballsy guy you are. Like, all the things that you've tried, and that you're kind of willing to do just about anything. And for as much as you've crossed over to a mainstream, you know, figurehead of the sport, you are still the guy that will go do something on Jackass. I like that about
you. But also, you know, because I don't want to take the fun out of skating. I mean, we skate because it's fun. It wasn't about trying to make money or be the best necessarily. It was just more about we loved doing it because we enjoyed it, and we were kids when we started doing it.
There was a picture of you that I remember at the time really encapsulated for me what I loved about skating. And you were doing, I think, a lean air over a channel on a ramp, and you had this big bug-eyed look on your face.
Oh, yeah.
Looking right at the camera.
And Neil Blender shot that photo.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Amazing. I thought, like, that's skating. Like, here's someone who's doing what 5, 6, 7 people can do in the whole world. The hardest thing. I mean, I could never do those. I always wanted to. And you're doing it with this completely irreverent attitude.
Yeah.
You know, and that to me is what skating is, and I'm glad you mentioned that it's artistic, because I think that it is completely artistic, and you are somebody who has contributed probably more tricks to the sport than anybody. And I heard that you actually kept a trick notebook. Tell me a little bit about like that your artistic approach to creating new tricks or whatever.
Well, when I first started sort of inventing tricks, I was pretty unknown amateur. And I was just trying to figure out ways to sort of maneuver my board. And there were tricks that I wanted to do that existed that were, you know, on the forefront of what innovation was, but I was just too small, and I didn't have the experience or the ability to get in the air to do these tricks. So I just figured out how to do them sort of under the coping and in my own way. And then as I grew and started being able to get in the air, I took these tricks into the air, and it was like, whoa, no one's ever done that before. And then my big motivation was just to figure out how to combine existing tricks. What if you do the varial, but what if you do it while you're doing a 360? You know, that kind of thing. That was my mindset. And so skating was such an open book then that you could put tricks together and voila, you have a new one. And you get to name it. And, you know, that was kind of that's how things would go for me. So through basically like 81 to 91, just hundreds of tricks were coming, and I would just try it. And a lot of the times they would go to no appreciation. It was just like, oh, well, that's some goofy Tony thing and whatever. No one's going to care about that. But I was stoked that, you know, it was new. That's all I cared about, was that it was new. It was different.
In one of your autobiographies, you have a complete glossary of all the tricks, and at some point it's like, oh my god, you know?
Yeah, it's weird now, because now, I mean, you look at street skating is all about how you combine tricks. You know, it's almost like a video game. It's hard flip to nose slide to nollie heel out, you know, and at some point skating got so technical that is what is happening, and so it would be pretentious to say, well, this is my own trick, because you're just combining all these other tricks. And so in my youth, I was thinking, well, maybe I was a bit pretentious trying to claim all these tricks as my own when all I was doing was combining existing tricks. But it's just different now, because it is much more like a video game, in that you have this ledge and you can do all these different things along the ledge. And in skateboarding, especially with the airtime we get, you know, it's like, oh, you can do a heel flip frontside 540, but you don't get to claim that as your own anymore.
Well, it's funny. There is kind of like this artistic respect, I think, also that goes back and forth. Just like, you know, if you have respect for yourself as an artist, you're not going to rip off somebody else's work. And like, I'm sure there were tricks that other skaters kind of made their signature thing that you didn't do, probably out of respect of like you're not going to do a Christ air or whatever.
Right, yeah.
Was there something to that? Like, yes.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
did you go and do that on your own and you could do it?
Kind of, yeah. You did have respect for and there were certain guys that had no shame about stealing tricks and doing it. Tony Magnuson, for one. We used to call him Xerox.
Because he would just learn
just
someone else's
trick. Yeah. Just like, hey, I just learned that. Like, give me a moment with it.
So there was an actual kind of unspoken code that, like,
yeah,
if you were cool, you didn't just take someone else's trick.
Yes.
That's interesting. Because it's such a more complex idea of sport, mm-hmm. you know, because I guess, you know, to take something that everyone understands has these, you know, these built-in structures like gymnastics or figure skating or something like that. And, you know, everyone does the same thing and that's how it's judged. In skateboarding, yeah. it's impossible to judge because everyone's doing different things on purpose.
Yeah.
I think that makes it a more creative pursuit than just about any other sport.
Yeah, well, I like that it's subjective as well. So it's all a matter of opinion. And you know, I guess that's what drives me crazy when people say, it's, you know, I know it's a kid mindset, but they say like, well, are you better than so-and-so? And it's like, I don't know. Is this art better than this art? I can't,
sure.
you know, we're not jumping hurdles here. We're just creating our own voice.
Right. I remember a letter in Thrasher in, say, 1983 that some, you know, mail bag or mail drop,
right.
I think, and some kid had written, hey, I'm on my way to study architecture, and so in 15 years, look out for a bunch of skatable transitions.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And I was thinking about you, kind of, you kind of did that. You kind of became the ultimate skate double agent. You figured out a way to, within the system to get skate spots built.
Well, what I saw, in the early 2000s, I saw the interest in skate parks rising, and the cities that were getting the skate parks were more affluent, and the city councils were very self-congratulatory when they would get a skate park going because they're hip, they're cool, and they would build this park that was terrible. It was like the sidewalk contractor had the lowest bid for the job. He saw maybe a video game of skateboarding and said, I can do that, and built something that wasn't even fun to skate. And I went to a couple of these openings, and I was very disappointed in the park and in the attitude and the fact that they didn't include the skaters themselves in the design process. And so I set out to change that tide, but also to get the funding as much as possible to the cities that are more in need, where there's kids that really have no other outlets, that don't have any facilities, that possibly are discouraged from skating if they've found skating, and are told that they can't skate, and maybe getting into something more subversive because of that. And I felt like I have this voice now and this recognition that I can maybe help change that. And so that's what I did. I set out, actually, the seed money for the foundation was the money I won from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Oh, really?
Yeah, $125,000. That was our first injection. That was our fund. And then to start collecting applications from people who want to get parks in their area, giving us, you know, their area, their nearest parks, their median income, and what work they've already done, because we want to empower people that want parks already. We're not trying to come in and say, Compton needs a skate park, we wave a magic wand and here you go, and then, you know, pat ourselves on the back. We really want them to feel like they have ownership of it, they have pride in it, they got the ball rolling. And so we look for communities that have done that, you know, down to petitioning the city or attending council meetings, having car washes, fundraisers, whatever they're doing is what we're looking for, because we want to give them the tools to do it, but we don't want to claim that we are the ones that made it happen.
I see. And has it been a really fulfilling thing? Like, is there an example of...
Yeah, it's been awesome. We've helped to develop, well, helped to fund over 500 parks now. We've given away over $4 million. Our fundraiser, huge success, the Center for Skate Parks event. I think the ones that I like to focus on, like I said, Compton. We actually did fund a park in Compton because the city council there was open to it. Obviously the residents, the skaters themselves wanted it, and they were petitioning for it. And we helped them build a world-class skate park right there in the middle of Compton. And that's such an iconic city for Los Angeles.
Sure.
You know, that's associated with a lot of other negative things, but I went to the grand opening, like they have this world-class skate facility right there in the middle of the city, and it's awesome. And same goes for, I mean, we've done stuff even on Native American reservations. We've done plots of land with just, you know, some modular skate facility, but they're stoked that they have something. It's been amazing. I mean, I love going to the grand opening as much as possible. We did one under Manhattan Bridge, which is just on the very lower end of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look under that bridge, there is a super good skate plaza that we helped to fund.
That's amazing. I mean, especially considering hardly any kid today could even conceive of what it was like in like 87, 88. There was nothing.
Nothing, yeah, yeah.
Once Del Mar closed and Upland closed,
yeah.
I mean, just finding a skate spot and the crappiest things that were skated religiously every day because there was nothing else.
Yeah, that's the hardest misconception for me to deal with is that people think that we just walk in and go, you need a skate park. And I guess my pet peeve in that process is the kids that say, you need to build me a skate park in this city. Like, no, you need to help yourself get a skate park in the city. I'll give you the tools to do it and some funding if you've shown that you put the effort forth, but why, you know what I mean? Why can't you help in this process?
Your dad passed away a while ago, and I wondered what changed for you after he died, or if there was any kind of shift. You know, just speaking as growing older and losing someone that was that important to you.
Was there a shift? I don't think there was really a shift. I mean, if anything, as the years passed, there was a disappointment that he didn't get to see how big it got. You know, because the things that I got to do and the opportunities just with skateboarding in general were stuff that he never really imagined, I don't think. You know, I think he wanted to see it get to a level where it was more appreciated, but I think he had no idea that it was going to be this giant success and industry and activity and on TV all the time. And, you know, I got to skate in the White House. Like, he would have never imagined that. So what shifted for me, I guess when he died, what shifted for me was just that he instilled a sense of priority, especially with your kids, in me. And my son was relatively young when he passed away, and that made me realize, well, it's up to me now, and I've really got to give him my best effort and my time and not just make it about me and have him second string.
Now, your son Riley is a pro skater now.
Yeah.
And do you find yourself, were there lessons that you definitely took away from your dad where you find yourself kind of saying, oh my gosh, I've turned into my parents?
No, not really, because we're in an even trickier situation in terms of my success and him having to sort of escape that shadow. So I know not to meddle, you know, in it too much. But at the same time, I do want to share it with him, and I want to show him that I'm proud of him, that I appreciate it. You know, I don't want him to think I'm just like, okay, you're over here now. Because he does. He has his own set of sponsors, and he has his own success. It was funny, though, because... And I think that we've come to an understanding now and appreciation for each other's space and skating, that it's way more fun for us now. You know, that we do have a distinct separation, but at the same time we have of mutual appreciation. He actually came, he came over last night and I was showing him this trick that I just learned. I was like, oh yeah, look at this trick. And he said, oh, that's awesome. I actually just learned that in a ditch. I had never thought about doing that before. Like, he had just learned this exact trick a week before.
Really?
That I just learned on vert without any, we didn't have any communication about it or anything. It was just so such an odd epiphany for me where it was like, really? You just learned that? What is going on? What a strange life we lead.
Do you see genetic traits in him where you're like, oh, that's me? Like,
Yeah, for sure.
Really?
Yeah.
And
he's got a way better style than me, but definitely there are times, especially when he lands tricks, he has the same sort of, he has the same stature.
Really?
Yeah. But he also, I think that he has a constant drive to improve what he does and to make it different than what other people are doing.
That's got to make you proud.
Yeah, it's great to see. It's awesome.
I mean,
that's rare these days in skating. You know, skating is very... As artistic as it is, there is a sort of formula and a cookie cutter process to becoming pro and the tricks that you need, and he's abandoned that.
How different is it for him at his age than when you look back at yourself at the same age? What is he, 20, 21?
He's 20, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just different in terms of how big skating is and the opportunities that he has and the fact that he can do it for a living.
Now, around that time, when you were around 20, was that about when you were starting to go broke or?
No, I was doing pretty well, like when I was 20, you know, and doing well enough that I didn't see an end in sight.
Right.
I think that was the mistake I made, where it was suddenly, you know, we were doing really well when we felt invincible. And it was like, the sky's gonna fall for sure.
And tell me about that at your lowest point.
At my lowest point, that was probably about when I was about 25, yeah, 25, 26. Riley was younger. I was taking care of him for the most part. I had started a skate business, and it was scraping along. And you know, I didn't have that many opportunities to do exhibitions or to, you know, every time that a sponsor would call me, it was to tell me that they're cutting my salary in half again. Like, that was the communication I had with my sponsors at the time. Like, hey, oh yeah, Tracker called. Oh yeah, they're cutting you in half. Oh, okay. Airwall called. Oh, they're not gonna pay you anymore. All right, you know, it was things like that. And so it got very discouraging. Riley's mom, my wife at the time, she was a manicurist and she would make cash mostly. And so her cash was our bread and butter for food and groceries and things like that.
Tell me about starting Birdhouse. Was it a huge learning curve for you in terms of a whole new skill set?
Yeah, it was weird. When we first started, my partner and I took a mortgage out on my house. He had money saved. We both put in, I think it was $40,000 and started Birdhouse and a distribution company at the same time. It was hard. I mean, it was, you know, it shifted my focus in terms of skating. I was now the Stacy Peralta of my team. They were staying at my house now. I was shooting video. I was doing the ads. I mean, I was at one point, there were only three of us really working for Birdhouse, three of us. And I'm calling shops, trying to get them to take orders of our stuff. You know,
that's gotta feel a little weird too.
It
right?
was weird,
hey, this
yeah.
This is Tony Hawk, and I'm wondering if.
Yeah. Yeah. And getting shut down at the same time. You know, I'm thinking that maybe my name carries some weight and that I can talk a shop into buying our stuff. And they're like, oh, well, we got to wait to see what the kids think about it before we buy anything.
What gave you the insight to, or the foresight to also start a distribution company at the same time?
Because I knew of a couple other people that wanted to do skate brands at the same time. They were startups and they didn't want to work with existing distributors. And so we distributed the Firm skateboards, which was Lance Mountain's company, and Real, which was Tommy Guerrero's company when we first started.
One thing I didn't know until I watched the Bones Brigade autobiography was how many guys started companies. In fact, Stevie was kind of the odd guy out for not starting a company.
Yeah.
You know, it is amazing how many people in that community, in that original community, have had success starting companies.
Yeah.
You know?
I think everyone thought that was their transitional phase for not being pro skaters anymore and being able to stay in the industry. That's what I thought. You know, I think that's exactly what Lance's frame of mind was too.
Right. You know, it also seems like for every guy that started a company, there were some real tragedies among guys that, you know, you think of Christian Hosoi and Jeff Phillips and Gator and some of these horrific things that guys went through. How did the news of some of your contemporaries, you know, falling really far affect you?
It was hard. I mean, I think there was a, you know, I don't want to say it was a dark cloud over skateboarding, but you could tell that the sudden rise to success and then the extreme drop in popularity affected people very badly. You know, it's very much behind the music type of stories where people turn to drugs or alcohol or their, you know, their unstable personalities came out in terrible ways. And so there was a period in skateboarding then, especially like it was already it had become unpopular, and the only time you ever heard anything was, you know, it was about, say, a murder case, like what happened with Gator or something else, you know, or Jeff Phillips' suicide, yeah. And you just heard, it was just like beating us when we're down, because skating was already struggling to stay afloat. And then it was just any news of it that was in the general media was just like, no, this is bad, bad, bad. And so that was hard to overcome for sure. For me, I think that was around the time when I was doing my best to promote it in a positive light. You know, I think that's probably when I learned that that's what it's going to take to bring skateboarding back to the forefront and to make it respectable again.
Is that kind of a motivator for you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, because at the time I would definitely be doing interviews and it would always turn to this, you know, well, what about this guy or what about this? And it was just like, well, you know, you can take different factions of people and choose that to represent it as a whole, but I don't think that's fair. You can't, you know, you can say, well, this football star got tried for murder as well. Does that make all the football players murder? You know what I mean? It was just, that was a hard thing to crawl out of for sure.
Well, I'm fascinated always by people who can have success in one area, in your case, an athletic, artistic pursuit like skating, and then go on to have this amazing success as really a brand and a businessman. And you know, it seems like you've done it in a way that you've kept who you are intact and at the center of that. Has that been a philosophy for you, even through social media and everything? Like, is there a philosophy that you have that you don't vary from, and that's contributed to your success?
I think I've just learned through success and failures to just be more true to what you really love doing. You know, I definitely, I don't think I had a creed in the beginning of how I'm going to approach this world of skateboarding, but skateboarding has always been so much about your performance than anything else. You know, you can't just become a rock star in skating because you look cool. You've got to put yourself out there, you know, and the people are so savvy about how you fare and how you rate. And so there was no hiding in that. And so I think if anything, the biggest chance that I took was jumping into mainstream endorsements and projects. You know, that was the moment where it was like, okay, this is where I'm putting myself out there for a lot of ridicule.
Were there some hard lessons in there?
Yeah, for sure. You know, and doing like at one point I was literally sponsored by McDonald's. And I don't regret that at all. I mean, when I was 16, 17 years old, if someone had offered me money from McDonald's and any sponsorship I took on at the time, I made sure I demanded that they donate money to the foundation. So I'm using McDonald's corporate money to build skate parks. You know, if someone had told me that was even possible when I was 17, I was signed up immediately, because it is who I am. I still eat McDonald's. I'm not ashamed of that. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like I was selling myself out or changing my values at all. But definitely that comes with a lot of scrutiny.
Right.
And I feel like because I did those things, I paved a way for, you know, a new group to be able to proudly say they're sponsored by Mountain Dew.
Right.
And knowing that with that sponsorship, they're allowed to do many more things. They're able to do many more things.
Right. And I totally get that. But I wondered if there was a time when you saw your name on something and said, oh.
That happened to me in the 80s.
Oh, it did?
Yeah. That's luckily I learned my lesson then before there was so much attention to it. But I was signing contracts left and right in the like mid to late 80s.
Is there not a particular example that you still cringe when you think about?
Well, the people who did those fingerboards, you know, the original fingerboards that were just plastic pieces of junk with a little paper in between, I signed a deal with them, and I didn't realize, but I actually had signed my name away for them to do whatever they wanted.
For them to make any product?
Whatever. And I went to their office one day. Well, they had started making, wallets and backpacks with a logo with my name that looked exactly like Vision Streetwear logo, but it was Tony Hawk skate gear. And I went to their office and I said, you can't do this without, and they're like, yeah, actually we can.
And they could.
Yeah, we can do that if we want to. And as I was having this conversation with the guy, I looked behind him and on his desk is a roll of toilet paper that says Tony Hawk gear on
no.
it.
No, toilet paper.
Toilet paper. And I was like, what is that? And he said, oh, well, that was just a joke with one of our retailers, because he said, you could put Tony Hawk's name on pretty much anything and it'll sell. And so we made that for him. Isn't that funny? And that was the moment where I was like, I can't believe that I gave these guys the rights to use my name. And if I ever get the chance in the future to do something with my name, I have final approval over it. And that was my lesson.
I hope you got that roll of toilet paper.
I didn't get it, but I did manage to get out of my contract with them without having to pay them very much.
Yeah, that, I mean, God, I mean, the decisions you make.
But going forward, and then when I did get, when I got a second chance in the late 90s to do stuff with, say, McDonald's, to do stuff, you know, video games, Activision, that kind of thing, every contract I signed, I had final approval over the finished product.
Right.
And how they would use my name and likeness. And I learned that because I did such terrible stuff in the 80s.
I think with how much transparency and how much your private life becomes personal now in the age of Twitter and social media and everything, I think it's really important to have an understanding of what that actually means.
Oh yeah, for sure. And you know, I've learned, talk about not listening to the haters. I mean, if you want haters, go on Twitter and look up your name. Jeez. And I've just learned to, you know, I've learned that I know when the things I'm doing are good and fun, and you can't listen to the hecklers.
Can you divorce yourself in some ways from that whole thing and just, can you still feel like you can maintain sort of a personal bubble? Like with your group of friends or?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, and there's stuff that I'm not gonna share on a daily basis. You know, there's also the mundane, and there's
sure.
the challenges of family life and travel and things like that. And you know, I'm not an open book in that respect. But I do want to make it, like I said, I want to make it fun and entertaining and interactive. If I'm gonna be out there doing it, I don't want, you know, there's so many people that get on the social networks, even celebrities, and they just put out the most boring shit. It's
yeah.
just like, I don't care that you want coffee right now. You know what I mean?
But I read something about you, I forget what publication, where they were making your Twitter feed an example of this is how you use social media.
Oh,
like when you put a skateboard in a dumpster and tweeted a picture of it. And I mean, was that a planned out thing, or is that more of like you playing with, like experimenting with the fact?
No, that was me realizing how fast information was traveling on the social networks and how prolific it had become. I mean, I think it was more, I remember I was in a restaurant, I was here in LA, I was in a restaurant and there was an earthquake. And I just typed in, you know, earthquake, oh my God. And then people were like, where, what, earthquake, what? And you know, these people had news about an earthquake in LA before any news outlet, because they were like, oh, yes, we, so-and-so, Travis Barker felt the same earthquake, you know what I mean? And they were piecing all these things together, and I realized like how fast that information is moving and how prolific it is. And I thought, what if you did a scavenger hunt type of thing? And I was driving to my office and I just had a skateboard in the car, so I pulled out on this cul-de-sac and hit it behind a bush. I hit a skateboard at the end of the street. Go find it. And by the time I got to my office, 10 minutes later, someone had tweeted a picture of them holding it and said that four other cars were pulling up at the same time. And I thought, God, there's something there. There's something really fun and interactive and engaging in that.
And is it, have you found it's just as valid a way to kind of interact with your fans
as a
demo was 20 years ago or whatever?
Yeah, for sure. And to get a, you know, it's the best focus group ever. Because they're unfiltered.
Right.
And if, you know, if you're going to do something and if you're going to put it out there for public consumption, you might as well find out if they're going to want it first.
I think the thing that that makes you kind of unique in this world is that your love of all this stuff does seem to shine through. Like, and I wonder, I still get that feeling, you know, if I'm on a job out of state somewhere and I'm driving down a street and I see a skate park, I still get that little feeling like, oh, we should go skate that. You know, do you still have kind of that feeling of, oh, here's something I haven't skated, and that feeling you used to get as a kid, does that change?
No, it hasn't changed. It's just different now in that, well, I guess in terms of being recognizable, you know, to go to a skate park, it's exciting and fun for me, but the moment I show up at a skate park, people sit down and think I'm gonna put on a show and I'm gonna do all these amazing things that they've seen on TV or in video games, and I'm just there to skate with the group and get used to it and figure out what's fun there. Do you know what I mean? And
that's the bad side of Twitter.
Right. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, and then if you do skate and you suck and someone shoots it on video, it's out there forever. But I'm not so vain that I'm not going to, you know, put myself up to that risk. It's just it's an interesting time, and it is a strange existence though to be in that, under that microscope.
What do you still get most up for? Is it still skating? Is there like a next act for you, or is it just continuing on this path? Or
I, to be honest, we started this YouTube channel called Ride, and we're in our second year of that, and that's been really fun. That's really given me a new outlook and new opportunities to go do interviews with people I find interesting. It's given us a venue, a forum to put new videos out to maybe cover stuff in skating that generally wasn't covered, or to bring it to a bigger audience. Stuff like that I get really excited about. You know, I still skate as much as possible and I still love doing it, but it's whatever other opportunities sound interesting and challenging and fun to me, that's what I'm doing. And a lot of charity stuff, you know, with not only my foundation, but also with like Laureus Sport for Good Foundation, with Operation Smile. And spreading that awareness as much as I can to my audience.
Right. Well, I mean, it's amazing to talk to you and hear about all this, because, you know, I've followed your career and I just really appreciate.
Oh, well, thanks for
taking
having
the time and you know, coming down.
I can honestly say there have been very few interviewers that are as well versed as you are in skating and the cycle of it and everything.
Yes, if there was an interview I was prepared for just by my lifestyle growing up, this would have been it. And just in parallel, I can appreciate how hard what you've done is, because I tried to do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just seeing you still doing it is totally inspiring.
Oh, thanks.
You know?
Well, on the flip side of that, I took photography in high school and I sucked at it, so.
Good, well. I think you made the right choice, and so did I. But thank you for coming on this.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, that's great.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.